of modern property. However, it hurts us to think of the ashes of Uncle Joan's bird being disturbed in the moving of the Van Buren Cemetery, and that never again will a country boy stand at the top of Backbone.
This is Mr. Ezra Sparrow, who is going to tell us a little something about Glenn Van Buren.
Upon the completion of the Corps of Engineers Dam at Taylorsville, the picturesque little village Van Buren will be no more. Situated at the confluence of Crooked Creek and Salt River, and near the point where Nelson, Spencer, and Anderson counties come together, it has served as a meeting place for friends and neighbors for more than a century. Born in 1894, it has been our privilege to have known Van Buren in its heyday, a period when most who know will agree should be known as the period when J.E. Blackburn and C.W. Ashby operated two of the largest and most complete general stores to be found throughout all a wide area. Around the large stores in the winter and on the front the porches provided benches provided at the front porches in the summer, a group of neighbors could usually be found. Some of these on winter days would even spend the entire day, depending on the Cracker Barrel and the large round of sharp cheese for lunch. Before the days of bottled soft drinks, someone was sent to one of the two never-failing wells for buckets of fresh water at stated times during the day. Daily bulletins of the happenings of the community, conditions of crops, affairs of government, politics, religion, and hunting and fishing in season provided the grist that kept talk going. Now and then, when certain individuals were together, all at the same store, a contest of tall stories was sure to ensue. These might center on some exploit of the Civil War, feats of skill and strength at log rollings, or regular workings when neighbors got together, are just plain fish tails. The store loafing spots serve these citizens of the Van Buren community in those days as modern clubs do today. The two general stores in Van Buren were alike in most respects, except that Blackburn's store carried full lines of wearing apparel, while Ashby's store carried only work clothes for men and calico and gingham dress goods for women. Blackburn's was the only country store that we knew where one could buy ready-made suits, standard brand shoes, and had a department where one could buy a tailored suit. What was a typical day for Mr. Blackburn or Mr. Ashby? Many mornings each would be called to open his store to supply some farmer's pressing need for that day. A bale of wire, some nails, staples, parts of gear, or just about anything used on the farm. The flow of continuous customers during the day would vary, but serving a vital area, there was usually one or more during the entire day. Closing time for both stores was usually about 10 o'clock at night. These two were good businessmen. They also were friends of the folks who made their business. The Van Buren community had a typical agricultural economy. The Salt River bottoms and the limestone upland adjacent to them furnished corn, wheat, rye, oats, and pasture. Area and upland new ground gave the farm community its money crop, tobacco. This, in brief, was the Van Buren of the Blackburn Ashby era as we knew it. We were never able to learn the origin of the name Van Buren. We have always supposed that the name was in honor of President Martin Van Buren. We vaguely remember when Blackburn's store was operated by Mr. Jake Newman, who was killed by an overturned wagon while hauling goods from the railroad depot in Lawrenceburg. We can remember distinctly when the store was operated by Mr. J.B. Black, who rather late in life married Miss Nanny Sweeney of the well-known Anderson County and Lawrenceburg family. Later, Mr. Black took J.E. Blackburn as a full partner, and in a few years decided to retire, selling his interest to his partner. We do not remember the Ashby store when it was operated by Mr. Bill Ash. We do remember the old store building with its center skylights and seat of Ashby Sr. and his wife, the former Lily Spire, granddaughter of the Reverend Henry Spire, half-brother of Nancy Hanks Lincoln. At its peak, Van Buren could boast, besides the two rather famous country stores, two blacksmith shops, an undertaking establishment, a hotel, a flour mill, a school, and a church. Also, it had a resident general practitioner, grandfather of Dr. W.B. Blackburn, prominent Frankfurt physician and surgeon. About the first decade of this century, Van Buren was to have a bank and a large hall that served both the Maccabees and the Masons. Van Buren knew the era of the drummer with his lines of goods, the peddler wagons that brought produce and also hauled goods from Louisville for their store. The stores of Van Buren at the time of the horse and buggy and two-horse wagons were the points of real bartering. Someone once said, Van Buren is a place where one can sell anything produced on the farm for cash, or can trade it for anything that we would ordinarily need for his family and for his farm operation. After the advent of the automobiles and trucks, this was somewhat changed, but as late as 1950s, we found the best of hams at Ashby's store, and at Christmas times one could choose from a 7,000 pound stock of old-fashioned assorted candies. People came from miles around, even from as far away as Lowell each year for this alone. Who were the people of Van Buren three quarters of a century ago? We knew these. The family of Mr. Green Milton, whose sons included two doctors and a Church of Christ minister, and who married into the Goodnight family, for whom the bridge across Salt River was named. Mr. Goodnight was the son of Michael Goodnight and Elizabeth Smith, sister of the wives of the Reverend Henry Spire and his brother Thomas. We well remember Uncle Jerry Sullivan, longtime leader of the Van Buren Church, Mr. Goins, and Mr. Jim and John Dadisman, and their families, Mr. J.D. Goins and wife Melissa Spire, a fourth-generation descendant of Lincoln's grandmother, Lucy Shipley Hanks. Mr. Cannon Simpson and Mr. Mark Stevens partly raised our families in Van Buren. Mr. J. Sweezy was a well-known blacksmith, and his family married into the families of the Reverend B.F. Atkins and Ed Ashby. These are some of the names that we remember best. Always considered a part of the Van Buren heritage is the Driscoll family, whose extensive land holdings were east of Van Buren, one-half mile. We knew Mr. Did Driscoll well, as he was the moneyed man of his day and noted for his business acuity. With the passing of J.E. Blackburn and C.D. Ashby, Van Buren went into a decline. Now little is left of the buildings that must be moved before the impounded water covers what was once an idyllic village. We still like to remember the call to worship at the Van Buren Church and on bright Sunday mornings, and the sound of the horse trotting over the Goodnight Bridge with the buggy it was pulling loaded with farm produce for bartering at one of the stores at Van Buren. We cannot stand in the way of modern progress. However, it hurts us to think of the ashes of Uncle George Burge being disturbed in the moving of the Van Buren Cemetery. and that never again will a country boy stand at the top of Backbone Hill and view the lovely little village that we knew nestling in the valley below.
That's good. Do you recall how, what age you were on your first visit to Van Buren?
Well, I don't know. And it seems to me that I must have been about not more than 5 years old when we went down to Van Buren, and then my folks used, that was my paternal grandfather and grandmother, and we usually visited both stores, and we were at noontime down at the store. Mr. C.W. Ashby Sr., that was the father of Arch and Charlie Ashby. And by the way, I didn't mention Arch in that, because he was an old bachelor that never married and ran the store, and later his brother, who also never married, ran the store until his death. And I remember this distinctly, that as a little boy, I didn't care too much for the shop cheese and cracker barrel crackers that they had, but I remember Cousin Lily went into the rooms where they lived or were adjacent to the store and brought me back a plate and a biscuit and butter and some pie preserves, and I remember that I ate that. I don't remember anything much about our trading, but I know that I could not have been more than 5 years old when that happened.
Did you ever go to church in Van Buren?
Oh, yes. I've been to church in Van Buren.
What denomination is it?
It was first a conservative Christian church, but later it became a Church of Christ. It really never had an organ, but later on, with W.L. Armstead, our Church of Christ preacher came in there, and he had them chained, and there's really not much difference in that and a lot of the other country churches I knew. The Christian churches, very few of them, had any musical instrument when I was a boy.
Do you recall any of the ministers' names that served
the church? Oh, yes. I used to hear Grandpa say that when he would go down to Uncle Jim, and by the way, Uncle Jim's fair, he was another one of the cousins of Abe Lincoln, that is also buried in the New Liberty Cemetery. And they used to go to the Van Buren Church, and Grandpa would go down there, and they would go, it's about a mile and a half from where the Uncle Jim lived up on the hill up from Crooked Creek. So they would go down, and Grandpa said that he would get there, and it seemed like he wasn't going to have any crowd. But just about on the time, 11 o'clock, Brother Jones would march in to the pulpit and say, "Brethren, let's see." And he said, seemingly all at once, that the church was filled with people. They always had bigger. W. Jones was a Mercer County man, and he always said that he was not the famous Sam Jones, the evangelist, noted evangelist of a former era, but that he was W. Jones, the cornfield Jones, because he was a farmer. And he had a quite extensive farm in Mercer County, but he did drive to Van Buren. He was one of the first preachers that I remember. I remember Brother Adolphus Mountjoy was a great uncle of Lynn Mountjoy of this country. And then, of course, I remember some of the later preachers. I remember Brother Bob Trey, and who, by the way, was a preacher and a businessman too. And he and his sons had the Craig Realty Company in Shelbyville, Kentucky.
Were there any stills in the Van Buren area?
Well, yes. I'm bound to say that there was. And I had better not call the name, because his grandfather was of my grandfather's family. But during the era of the Depression, he owed some money, and he decided that the best way he'd make a little money was to put a little still in. And he got caught, and that ended that, and so far as I know, that was the only one there. Although, down in that section, I do know that there was a man that engaged in that and was never caught. And he engaged in that and what is known as bootlegging. And one of the things I have failed to mention, that near Van Buren, there was two picnic grounds. One was at the Goodnight Bridge, about a mile up east of Van Buren on the road, that's known as the Glenburg Van Buren Road, and then further up where they go out to what is known as the Crusherville Pond. It's a nice grove of trees and a nice shady place, and they used to have their regular picnics, and sometimes in the days when we had a number, and I remember attending one of these when there were a number of old Civil War soldiers left, and they had a Civil War reunion, and they had a colored band, and they had a march, and I remember Grandpa and Uncle Lige and Uncle Jim Bergen and a few of the others marching, and there was a few of the old rebel soldiers sort of objected to having the colored band. but they had that. And then they used to have their picnics, and they'd have dancing, and they used to have a little of the cup of cheers, and they would have quite a time, and sometimes they had some quite squally time. That was one of the Sweezy family was Mr. Willow Sweezy, and he was noted as a sort of a Wild West sort of man, and a gunslinger, and sometimes he would get a little bit lit. And there was also another man by the name of Bill Neal that was quite a fighter too, and they came together one time, and Bill Neal used to laugh. He said Sweezy was the man that made him run. He said when he started at him, he saw shoot in the man's eye, and he got away from him. He would laugh about that.
About how many people lived in Van Buren around 1900?
Oh, I don't know. Probably. I would have to count. I would say there were never more than 60, I would say never more than 100 people living in the area. Now we have to make a distinction as what we'll call Van Buren, because we got in what we call Van Buren by about the time that we passed where the last school building. There was two school buildings in Van Buren. And by the way, I taught my first school 56 years ago last month. I began there. Yes, 56 years ago last month, I began my first school at Van Buren. And we thought that was at that. Although Mr. Gowen's house was up just a tiny little bit, up a little bit further. But, and then up in the bottom from Van Buren, Mr. Cannon Simpson's house, up the creek just a little way, was Mr. Jerry Sullivan and some of the married daughter of Mr. C.W. Ashby, and then down the creek just a little way, and then just across the river, and whether we consider all that little cluster of houses Van Buren, I would say never more than 100 people in the little settlement area.
Did the blacktop roads cause the people to gradually move from there? Or what would you say caused it?
I think, and one of the things that I think with the ushering in of the automobile age, and the people as they become those that had been to high school, and a few people had been to college, and they began to want to go to Louisville and Lexington. They could go to Louisville or Lexington quicker than I could go to Van Buren in my early boyhood days.
But it was a rather fertile area for the county, wasn't it?
I remember Uncle Tom Sparrow, my grandfather's half-brother, lived down just a little bit, and he had a made earth bottom. And we went down to Uncle Tom's to spend the night one time in the fall of the year, corn grubbing time. And I remember Uncle Tom saying, "Lev, this is the 40th year. I've been living here 40 years, and I have cultivated this bottom in corn every year. And this year I have the heaviest crop of corn that I've ever had." They would build a stone fence out next to the river, and then when the rise would come, the water would flow over. If the water went down slowly, it left all the silt on the inside, and that helped to keep fertilized. And you could plow down, and you wouldn't get to the bottom of that, no telling how deep you would go. And they just cultivated them every year. And if it was dry, They now a real rainy season, they didn't do too well. But if there's anything like a regular season, but especially if it was a dry season, they'd have corn that would make 40 bushels an acre, which was a big yield then, when nothing was made on the hills. Even in the drought of 1881, they had corn down the upper town bottom. Mm-hmm.
Did the people live fairly well there during the Depression years?
Oh, and they didn't have any money at all. But so far as living, what we call living, and my definition of living, if you live in a community where you have good neighbors. Neighbors that will come and help you, come and do you when you are sick or anything. But if you have plenty to eat and sufficient to wear, you can go to church, you can mingle with your people while you're living. Well, you don't really need much money.
One other thing, when the you said there were two schools there at one time. When were they moved from from Van Buren?
With the consolidation that was at Western.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
I believe that was the full consolidation came about the time of the consolidation of the merging of Anderson and Cavanaugh. I mean of Lawrenceburg and Cavanaugh into Anderson High School.
That was around 1948-49.
That's about 48 or 49. Mm-hmm.
And you taught your first school there.
I taught my first school there in 1920, and then the next year I went to Johnsonville, and I taught the school year 21-22 and 22-23. And then in 23-24 I did attendance work, and then in the fall of 1925 I started Western High School in the old store building at Johnsonville.
Was your school adequate, or was it very crude?
Now we have to qualify that word adequate. You know, it's said that Mark Hopkins one time said that a university, if you have Mark Hopkins on one end of a log and a student on the other, you have a university. I think one of the students that I taught at first to read in first grade, Dorothy Hurst Sheely, and she told me one time that she was asked to read for her organization at church because she was the best reader in the group. And she told me this and smiled when she said, "Mr. Israel, remember you taught me to read. My first reading." And I felt rather proud of that because actually I didn't know how to read, but I did know how to get on my feet. I didn't know how to express myself because I'd learned those things at Cavanaugh. And actually, I think, Ann, that in regard to schools, the school at Van Buren, the school at the school anywhere, whether it's what we call a well-equipped school, like the new Emma Ward Elementary School, or our present consolidated Anderson Senior High School, or our junior high school. I think the teacher and the student, the teacher's job is not so much, the teacher's biggest job is not so much explaining to them how they shall work on a problem in arithmetic, or how they shall analyze a sentence in English grammar, but it is this, that the teacher do this intangible or something that's hard to define, but this teacher must have something that makes the student want to know. And if one wants to know, you know how much that you have here in your library. You know how much that your bookmobile is able to do. You know how much you're able to call on the State Library Association for. And actually, if one wants to know, if they have the rudiments of reading and understanding language, they can acquire the knowledge that they want. But the teacher is to make them want to know.
One thing you mentioned that I was interested in, that they had a mortician.
Oh, yes.
In Van Buren. how did they go about taking care of the dead back in those days?
They, when one died, some of the neighbors, if it was a woman, some of the neighbor women, they let what they call laid out the corpse. That is, they did the washing and changing of clothes, arranging of hair, and things like that. There was no embalming. And then, usually in a few hours after the death, there, if it was summertime especially, that there would be the burial. But if it was wintertime, it probably would be the next day. And then, of course, Mr. Dasman had his casket forms, and then he did they did the trimming inside, and put they put that crepe and lining and thing. Usually the caskets were black, and I think I was almost grown before I ever saw a flower at a funeral. But they would come and bring the casket and put the corpse in the casket, and then put on the, they didn't have the regular form, but a kind of trestle thing that they set the casket on. And then folks would come in and visit. People would bring in things for the folks to eat. And then always, folks didn't think about going to bed, but somebody always had to set up with the corpse.
So actually the mortician just was...
The mortician just came and buried them, that's right.
And sold the casket.
And I used to say, I'll not call any names, but I used to say, a certain mortician that I knew was also had a blacksmith shop, that I used to say that as a mortician, he was a fair blacksmith.
Mm-hmm. Fair blacksmith. Mentioned that there was a bank in Van Buren. When do you recall when it opened or when it closed?
The bank opened around sometime during the first decade of this century, sometime between 1901 and 1910. Mr. McElroy was the first cashier of the bank, just one employee, and then afterward Mr. Hubert Hobbs was the next. He was the next cashier of that bank, and then Mr. Lev Milton, the one who became a preacher in the Church of Christ, was also one time. And then Mr. Oscar Adkins, he was a son of the Reverend B.F. Adkins and the father of Dr. Jerry Adkins, a well-known dentist in Versailles, Kentucky.
What did the people do for their pleasure in Van Buren? You recall?
Van Buren in its heyday also knew, now some people would not have dances at their house. Some of the church members, and even some of the churches, would turn members out if they were known to attend a dance and dance. But they had their country dances, and they had country fiddlers like Amos and Ed Ashley, which by the way were the famous old time fiddlers in that community. And Amos's son Willis was also a noted fiddler. And there was Jared Cook.
This is Mr. Ezra Sparrow, who is going to tell us a little something about Van Buren. Okay.
Upon the completion of the Corps of Engineers Dam at Taylorsville, the picturesque little village Van Buren will be no more. Situated at the confluence of Crooked Creek and Salt River, and near the point where Nelson, Spencer, and Anderson counties come together, it has served as a meeting place for friends and neighbors for more than a century. Born in 1894, it has been our privilege to have known Van Buren in its heyday, a period when most who know will agree should be known as the period when J.E. Blackburn and C.W. Ashby operated two of the largest and most complete general stores to be found throughout all a wide area. Around the large stoves in the winter, and on the front, the porches provided on the benches provided at the front porches in the summer, a group of neighbors could usually be found. Some of these on winter days would even spend the entire day, depending on the Cracker Barrel and the large round of sharp cheese for lunch. Before the days of bottled soft drinks, someone was sent to one of the two never-failing wells for buckets of fresh water at stated times during the day. Daily bulletins of the happenings of the community, conditions of crops, affairs of government, politics, religion, and hunting and fishing in season provided the grist that kept talk going. Now and then, when certain individuals were together, or at the same store, a contest of tall stories was sure to ensue. These might center on some exploit of the Civil War, feats of skill and strength at log rollings, or regular workings when neighbors got together, are just plain fish tales. The store loafing spots served these citizens of the Van Buren community in those days as modern clubs do today. The two general stores in Van Buren were alike in most respects, except that Blackburn's store carried full lines of wearing apparel, while Ashby's store carried only work clothes for men and calico and gingham dress goods for women. Blackburn's was the only country store that we knew where one could buy ready-made suits, standard brand shoes, and had a department where one could buy a tailored suit. What was a typical day for Mr. Blackburn or Mr. Ashby? Many mornings each would be called to open his store to supply some farmer's pressing need for that day. A lake of a bale of wire, some nails, staples, parts of gear, or just about anything used on a farm. The flow of continuous customers during the day would vary, but serving a vital area, there was usually one or more during the entire day. Closing time for both stores was usually about 10 o'clock at night. These two were good businessmen. They also were friends of the folks who made their business. The Van Buren community had a typical agricultural economy. The Salt River bottoms and the limestone upland adjacent to them furnished corn, wheat, rye, oats, and pasture area, and upland new ground gave the farm community its money crop, tobacco. This, in brief, was the Van Buren of the Blackburn-Ashby era as we knew it. We were never able to learn the origin of the name Van Buren. We have always supposed that the name was in honor of President Martin Van Buren. We vaguely remember when Blackburn's store was operated by Mr. Jake Newman, who was killed by an overturned wagon while hauling goods from the railroad depot in Lawrenceburg. We can remember distinctly when the store was operated by Mr. J.B. Black, who rather late in life married Miss Nanny Sweeney of the well-known Anderson County and Lawrenceburg family. Later, Mr. Black took J.E. Blackburn as a full partner, and in a few years decided to retire, selling his interest to his partner. We do not remember the Ashby store when it was operated by Mr. Bill Ash. We do remember the old store building with its center skylights and C.W. Ashby Sr. and his wife, the former Lily Spire, granddaughter of the Reverend Henry Spire, half-brother of Nancy Hanks Lincoln. At its peak, Van Buren could boast, besides the two rather famous country stores, two blacksmith shops, an undertaking establishment, a hotel, a flour mill, a school, and a church. Also, it had a resident general practitioner, grandfather of Dr. W.P. Blackburn, prominent Frankfurt physician and surgeon. About the first decade of this century, Van Buren was to have a bank and a large hall that served both the Maccabees and the Masons. Van Buren knew the era of the drummer with his lines of goods, the peddler wagons that brought produce and also hauled goods from Louisville for their stores. The stores of Van Buren at the time of the horse and buggy and two-horse wagons were the points of real bartering. Someone once said, Van Buren is a place where one can sell anything produced on the farm for cash. I can trade it for anything that we would ordinarily need for his family and for his farm operation. After the advent of the automobiles and trucks, this was somewhat changed, but as late as 1950s, we found the best of hams at Ashby's store, and at Christmas times, one could choose from a 7,000-pound stock of old-fashioned assorted candies. People came for miles around, even from as far away as Lowell each year for this alone. Who were the people of Van Buren 3/4 of a century ago? We knew those. We knew these. The family of Mr. Green Milton, whose sons included two doctors and a Church of Christ minister, and who married into the Goodnight family, for whom the bridge across Salt River was named. Mr. Goodnight was the son of Michael Goodnight and Elizabeth Smith, sister of the wives of the Reverend Henry Spire and his brother Thomas. We well remember Uncle Jerry Sullivan, longtime leader of the Van Buren Church. Mr. Goins and Mr. Jim and John Dadisman and their families, Mr. J.D. Goins and wife Melissa Spire, a fourth generation descendant of Lincoln's grandmother, Lucy Shipley Hanks. Mr. Cannon Simpson and Mr. Mark Stevens partly raised their families in Van Buren. Mr. J.H. Sweezy was a well-known blacksmith, and his family married into the families of the Reverend B.F. Atkins and Ed Ashby. These are some of the names that we remember best. Always considered a part of the Van Buren heritage is the Driscoll family, whose extensive land holdings were east of Van Buren, some 1/2 mile. We knew Mr. Did Driscoll well, as he was the moneyed man of his day and noted for his business acuity. With the passing of J.E. Blackburn and C.D.F. Ashby, Van Buren went into a decline. Now little is left of the buildings that must be moved before the impounded water covers what was once an idyllic village. We still like to remember the call to worship at the Van Buren Church and on bright Sunday mornings, and the sound of the horse trotting over the Goodnight Bridge with the buggy it was pulling loaded with farm produce for bartering at one of the stores in Van Buren. We cannot stand in the way of modern progress. However, it hurts us to think of the ashes of Uncle George Burge being disturbed in the moving of the Van Buren Cemetery, and that never again will a country boy stand at the top of Backbone Hill and view the lovely little village that we knew nestling in the valley below.
That's good. Do you recall what age you were on your first visit to Van Buren?
Well, I don't know, Anne. It seems to me that I must have been about not more than 5 years old when we went down to Van Buren, and my folks used, that was my paternal grandfather and grandmother, and we usually visited both stores. And we were at noontime down at the store of Mr. C.W. Ashby Sr. That was the father of Arch and Charlie Ashby. And by the way, I didn't mention Arch in that, because he was an old bachelor that never married and ran the store, and later his brother, who also never married, ran the store until his death. And I remember this distinctly, that as a little boy, I didn't care too much for the sharp cheese and cracker barrel crackers that they had, but I remember Cousin Lily went into the rooms where they lived, or adjacent to the store, and brought me back a plate and a biscuit and butter and some pie preserves, and I remember that I ate that. I don't remember anything much about our trading, but I know that I could not have been more than 5 years old when that happened.
Did you ever go to church in Van Buren?
Oh, yes. I've been to church in Van Buren.
What denomination is it?
It was first a conservative Christian church, but later it became a Church of Christ. It really never had an organ, but later on, with W.L. Armstead, our Church of Christ preacher, came in there, and he had them chained, and there was really not much difference in that and a lot of the other country churches I knew. The Christian churches, very few of them, had any musical instruments when I was a boy.
Do you recall any of the ministers' names that served
the
church?
Oh, yes. I used to hear Grandpa say that when he would go down to Arthur Jim's, and by the way, Uncle Jim's fair, he was another one of the cousins of Abe Lincoln, that is also buried in the New Liberty Cemetery. And they used to go to the Van Buren Church, and Grandpa would go down there, and they would go, it's about a mile and a half from where they, Uncle Jim lived up on the hill up from Crooked Creek. So they would go down, and Grandpa said that he would get there, and it seemed like he wasn't going to have any crowd. But just about on the time, 11 o'clock, Brother Jones would march in to the pulpit and say, "Brethren, let's sing." And he said, seemingly all at once, that the church was filled with people. They always had bigger. W. Jones was a Mercer County man, and he always said that he was not the famous Sam Jones, the evangelist, noted evangelist of a former era, but that he was W. Jones, the cornfield Jones. Because he was a farmer, and he had a quite extensive farm in Mercer County, but he did drive to Van Buren. He was one of the first preachers that I remember. I remember Brother Adolphus Mountjoy was a great uncle of Lynn Mountjoy, this country. And then, of course, I remember some of the later preachers. I remember Brother Bob Craig, and who, by the way, was a preacher and a businessman too, and he and his sons had the Craig Realty Company in Shelbyville, Kentucky.
Were there any stills in the Van Buren area?
Well, yes. I'm bound to say that there was, and I had better not call a name because his grandfather was of my grandfather's family, but during the era of Depression, he owed some money, and he decided that the best way he'd make a little money was to put a little still in. And he got caught, and that ended that, and so far as I know, that was the only one there. Although, down in that section, I do know that there was a man that engaged in that and was never caught, and he engaged in that and what is known as bootlegging. And one of the things I have failed to mention that near Van Buren there was two picnic grounds. One was at the Goodnight Bridge, about a mile up east of Van Buren on the road that's known as the Glenburg Van Buren Road, and then other up where they go out to what is known as the Crusherville Pond. It's a nice grove of trees and a nice shady place, and they used to have their regular picnics, and sometimes in the days when we had a number, and I remember attending one of these when there were a number of old Civil War soldiers left, and they had a Civil War reunion, and they had a colored band, and they had a march, and I remember Grandpa and Uncle Lige and Uncle Jim Bergen and a few of the others marching, and there was a few of the old rebel soldiers sort of objected to having the colored band. but they had that. And then down lower, they used to have their picnics, and they'd have dancing, and they used to have a little of the cup of cheers, and they would have quite a time, and sometimes they had some quite squally time. There was one of the Sweezy family was Mr. Willow Sweezy, and he was noted as a sort of Wild West sort of man, and a gunslinger, and sometime he would he would get a little bit lit. And there was also another man, the name of Bill Neal, that was quite a fighter too. And they came together one time, and Bill Neal used to laugh. He said, "Sweetie was the man that made me run." He said, "When he started at him, he saw shoot in the man's eye, and he got away from there." He would laugh about that thing.
About how many people lived in Van Buren around 1900?
Oh, I don't know. Probably, I would have to count. I would say there were never more than 60, I would say never more than 100 people living in the area. Now, we have to make a distinction as what we'll call Van Buren, because we got in what we call Van Buren by about the time that we passed where the last school building. There was two school buildings in Van Buren. And by the way, I taught my first school 56 years ago last month. I began there. Yes, 56 years ago last month, I began my first school at Van Buren. And we thought that was at that. Although Mr. Gowen's house was up just a tiny little bit, up a little bit further. And then up in the bottom from Van Buren, Mr. Cannon Simpson's house, up the creek just a little way, was Mr. Jerry Sullivan and some of the married daughter of Mr. C.W. Ashby. And then down the creek just a little way, and then just across the river. And whether we consider all that little cluster of houses Van Buren, I would say never more than 100 people in the little settlement area.
Did the blacktop roads cause the people to gradually move from there? Or what would you think caused it?
I think, Ann, one of the things that I think with the ushering in of the automobile age and the people as they become those that had been to high school and a few people had been to college, and they began to want to go to Louisville and Lexington. They could go to Louisville or Lexington quicker than I could go to Van Buren in my early boyhood days.
But it was a rather fertile area for the county, wasn't it?
Yes, it is. I remember Uncle Tom Sparrow, my grandfather's half-brother, lived down just a little bit. And he had a made earth bottom. And we went down to Uncle Tom's to spend the night one time in the fall of the year, corn grubbing time. And I remember Uncle Tom saying, "Lev, this is the 40th year. I've been living here 40 years, and I have cultivated this bottom in corn every year. And this year, I have the heaviest crop of corn that I've ever had." Those bottoms, they would build a stone fence out next to the river. And then when the rise would come, the water would flow over. If the water went down slowly, it left all the silt on the inside, and that helped to keep fertilizer. And you could plow down, and you wouldn't get to the bottom of that, no telling how deep you would go. And they just cultivated them every year. Mm-hmm. And if it was dry, a real rainy season, they didn't do too well. But if there's anything like a regular season, but especially if it was a dry season, they'd have corn that would make 40 bushels an acre, which was a big yield then, when nothing was made on the hills. Even in the drought of 1881, they had corn down in Upper Tom's bottom. Mm-hmm.
Did the people live fairly well there during the Depression years?
And they didn't have any money at all. But so far as living, what we call living, and my definition of living, if you live in a community where you have good neighbors that will come and help you, come to you when you are sick or anything. But if you have plenty to eat and sufficient to wear, you can go to church. You can mingle with your people while you're living. Well, you don't really need much money.
One other thing, when the you said there were two schools there at one time, when were they moved from from Van Buren?
With the consolidation that was at Western.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
I believe that was the full consolidation came about the time of the merging of Anderson and Kavanaugh. I mean, of Lawrenceburg and Kavanaugh into Anderson High School.
That was around 1948, 49.
That's about 48 or 49. Mm-hmm.
And you taught your first school there?
I taught my first school there. I taught my first school there in 1920. And then the next year I went to Johnsonville and I taught the school year 21, 22, and 22, 23. And then in 23, 24, I did attendance work. And then in the fall of 1925, I started Western High School in the old store building at Johnsonville.
Was your school adequate or was it very crude?
Now we'll have to qualify that word adequate. You know, it's said that Mark Hopkins one time said that a university, if you have Mark Hopkins on one end of a log and a student on the other, you have a university. I think the, for instance, one of the students that I taught at first to read in first grade, Dorothy Hurst Sheely, and she told me one time that she was asked to read for her organization at church because she was the best reader in the group. And she told me this and smiled when she said, "Mr. Israel, remember you taught me to read my first reading." And I felt rather proud of that because actually, I didn't know how to read, but I did know how to get on my feet. I didn't know how to express myself because I'd learned those things at Kavanaugh. And actually, I think, Ann, that in regard to schools, the school at Van Buren, the school at any the school anywhere, whether it's what we call a well-equipped school, like the new Emma Ward Elementary School, or our present Consolidated Anderson Senior High School or our Junior High School. I think the teacher and the student, the teacher's job is not so much, the teacher's biggest job is not so much explaining to them how they shall work on a problem in arithmetic or how they shall analyze a sentence in English grammar. But it is this, that the teacher do this intangible or something that's hard to define, but this teacher must have something that makes the student want to know. And if one wants to know, you know how much that you have here in your library. Mm-hmm. You know how much that your bookmobile is able to do. You know how much you're able to call on the State Library Association for. And actually, if one wants to know, if they have the rudiments of reading and understanding language, they can acquire the knowledge that they want. But the teacher is to make them want to know.
One thing you mentioned that I was interested in, that they had a mortician.
Oh, yes.
In Van Buren. How did they go about taking care of the dead back in those days?
They, when one died, some of the neighbors, if it was a woman, some of the neighbor women, they laid out the corpse. That is, they did the washing and changing of clothes, arranging of hair, and things like that. There was no embalming. And then, usually in a few hours after the death, there, if it was summertime especially, that there would be the burial. But if it was wintertime, it probably would be the next day. And then, of course, Mr. Dadisman had his casket forms, and then they did the trimming inside. And put that crepe and lining and thing. Usually the caskets were black. And I think I was almost grown before I ever saw a flower at a funeral. But they would come and bring the casket and put the corpse in the casket and then put it on they didn't have the regular form, but a kind of trestle thing that they set the casket on. And then folks would come in and visit. People would bring in things for the folks to eat. And then always, folks didn't think about going to bed, but somebody always have to set up for the corpse.
So actually,
they set up for the corpse.
So actually, the mortician just was.
The mortician just came and buried them. That's right.
And sold the casket.
And I used to say, I'll not call in a name, but I used to say a certain mortician that I knew was also had a blacksmith shop. That I used to say that as a mortician, he was a fair blacksmith.
Mm-hmm. Fair blacksmith. Mentioned that there was a bank in Van Buren. When do you recall when it opened or when it closed?
The bank opened sometime during the first decade of this century, sometime between 1901 and 1910. Mr. McElroy was the first cashier of the bank, just one employee, and then afterward Mr. Hubert Hobbs. He was the next cashier of that bank, and then Mr. Lev Milton, the one who became a preacher in the Church of Christ, was one.
Fiddlers, and you mentioned the name Jared Cook.
Well, Jared Cook was an old-time fiddler. He never married, and I used to hear my dad say that Mr. Cook said, "Well," said, "the weather boys have their nice buggy rigs to take the girls in, but," said, "I can really charm their hearts with my fiddling." And then Andy Palmer was one of the famous fiddlers and grew up not far from Van Buren. And by the way, when we used to have plays when I was principal down at Western High School, we used to have Alan Walsh and Bill Harden and Andy Palmer and a few of the other people in the community that played. Mr. Albert Hahn was one of them, that we had music in between acts at our plays. But then another form of recreation, and one that was most popular, especially in the summer months, I'll say beginning in June, running the months of June, July, and August, that moonlight parties. And it was not exactly in the Van Buren area, but it drew people from Van Buren and from back from all over Anderson County. Once every year, as an annual event, the family of Mr. J.E. Leathers held a what they called a moonlight party. They had plank seats fixed all around, and they had their yard was probably 150 yards from the front door to the front gate. And they had a walkway down, and the yard was as nice and level and well kept as any lawn in Lawrenceburg. And they had their Chinese lanterns all strung all around, and they would take the numbers from the card view calendar and cut numbers up to have matching numbers, give the boys' numbers and the girls' numbers, and somebody at the door, usually the host, girl and boy, they would act as a host at the door, and the boy would come up and present his number, and they'd call this crush on a girl, and they'd introduce him, and then you went around, and when they got them all seated, then they went around, and they having to change partners with somebody, and it's just like breaking at a dance. Instead of tapping on the shoulder, you went up and say, "Miss Jones, this is Mr. Smith," and Mr. Barnes probably would get up and he would go this and he'd take him around somewhere. And then the girls, it used to be that the boys did all the breaking, but finally, during my high school days, I think the girls, I'd say they would take the girls around and they would choose the boy that they wanted to break in on. So that lasted. And then in the wintertime, but the dances were usually in the wintertime. But another, for those that didn't dance, whose church prevented them from dancing, we had what was known as pound parties. I don't know, do you know what a pound party was? Well, a pound party, the boys brought a pound of stick candy. Just the stick candy, just like I mentioned that Charlie Ashby brought 7,000 pounds of that and assorted candies, but we usually got the stick candy, peppermint or lemon or cinnamon or some kind, and you could get a whole pound for a dime. Well, the girls would bake a cake, and then the host at the family would furnish pickle I don't know, did you ever eat candy and pickles and cake together? Well, that's what we did in those days. I don't know. Sometimes I think maybe the first is coffee, but it was lemonade wasn't practical because nobody had ice unless they'd go out and get it off the pond, and it wasn't very sanitary. But I think maybe sometimes they served us coffee. And then another one was we had apron parties, and they were events that came along in the spring just before the moonlight party started. Now the apron party, the girls would buy just a simple pattern, just a simple plain apron, and they would make it all except the hemming. And so they would save a little piece just about maybe a foot long, and it would be fixed just like a little string, fixed out, turned over and sewed together. And a boy would draw these, and then he went in and he got the girl whose apron this piece matched. And then he hemmed her apron with a needle and thread. And of course they talked and got in a little courting as they were doing this. And so at the end, when all the aprons were hemmed, a committee of women that were known to be good at seamstress, they came in and judged, and there was a little prize, maybe a box of candy or something for the boy who had the best apron, and then they had just a general social hour party. They might play blindfold or skip to Maloo or various things, but they had a good time.
Well, since it is on the Salt River, do you think this was the reason that the people settled there to begin with? Fact that it was a river, and was it a navigable river?
Well, of course, it's not navigable. None of that is navigable, and never has been. I don't know. I sort of think that the most of the people of Anderson County and Salt River and Van Buren people were typical of Anderson Countyans, and they are strictly people that is to be found in Appalachia. If I met Uncle Elliot Goodnight, I always said Uncle Elliot Goodnight. He and Grandpa were first cousins because their mothers were sisters, but he and Grandpa, if I heard them talking, if we met together, and Grandpa might say, Erica, I hope Jim killed hogs last week. They said hope instead of helped. And that's Shakespeare. And you find a lot of Shakespeare idioms among the people. And I think they were all of Anglo-Saxon stock.
But the river really never influenced their lives to any degree.
Well, I think they learned they learned the vagaries of the river. You see, I mentioned in my first paper that Van Buren was situated at the confluence of Crooked Creek and Salt River. I didn't mention that also on the other side, just a little ways from just a few hundred yards above Van Buren, was the mouth of Watts Run, which was a considerable creek when it got down there. And at the time of a sort of flash flood, this water coming in, it would sort of dam Salt River up and cause its flood. I remember one time that when before Mr. and Mrs. Black lived at Van Buren, they lived in the hotel property. They lived there, they never owned a home of their own. But Mr. Black was boarding at the hotel when he and Ms. Black married, and they lived there not too long. This one of these flash floods came in June, and Mr. Jim Hudson Sweezy, who I mentioned was the blacksmith at that time, he put on his rubber boots and carried a lot of the women out of their homes to higher ground, and Ms. Black was one that he carried out.
All right. Are there any family cemeteries or just one common cemetery in Van Buren?
Well, now there's a common cemetery at Van Buren. Well, now up the river, I mentioned the Driscoll land. Up the river is what is known as the Driscoll property. Over there, the Mr. Dennis Driscoll and I think Mr. and Mrs. J.D. Driscoll were married there. And by the way, that's Ms. Catlett's, Ms. Corrine Catlett's grandfather, and great grandfather, grandparents and grandparents and great grandparents. But Uncle Eddie Goodnight is also buried there. And when I was master of the Masonic Lodge at Beaver Creek, and Uncle Eddie Goodnight, of course, was a member of that lodge, and his was the first Masonic funeral that I did as master of the Beaver Creek Lodge.
What about log houses? Were the original housing in Van Buren, were they log construction, and are there any there now that you know of?
If there's any log houses there, I don't know. I think they were the first frame houses. Most of them would be out of material that was the timber was cut from the wooded hillsides close by, and there was a sawmill one time at Van Buren too, and that's for a number of years. When Mr. L.P. Juber Hahn, and by the way, I don't think I mentioned those in the families, well, he ran the mill down there, and he ran the had the sawmill, and they sawed their sills and the study and the rafters and plates and a great many of the flooring, and they sawed there was lots of poplar trees, and they sawed six inch poplar boards, 1/2 by 6 inches, the way they were sawed, and then the carpenter who built the house had a hand plane and would plane one side and one edge of those, the bottom edge that showed, and then left it just like up. And most of that construction, I think you'll find a lot of yellow poplar. Mm-hmm. And you found some, of course, some red oak and white oak, which was plentiful in that time.
So I guess.
But if there's any, some of the houses have been torn down. I think the old Van Buren, I haven't been down there for 2 or 3 years now, but I know the house where Mr. Art Tom Hedy, and by the way, that's another one that I didn't mention. He grew up, he had one son and several daughters, and he had his house by the side, right by the side of Crooked Creek. You could just pitch a rock over in the creek from the back of his porch. And one spring it was, that we had so many rises there. It was just after World War I, when people first saw overseas caps, they called them, on the soldier. And the men around the store up at Mr. Blackburn's, you and Mr. Ashby's store, they used to laugh, and Mr. Hedy would come in and said, "Well, I see you've got on your overseas cap," because he'd been run out of his house so many times in the last month by the flood. They told him he got to wear an overseas cap.
Talk about Mr. Ashby's store. There's a monkey down there now. Do you know how long that monkey's been in Van Buren? Or have you ever seen it?
No.
I don't know about that. Another thing I'm interested in is the family name of Goodnight. Do you have any idea where they came from? That's a strange.
I don't know. I know, as far as I know, back of that family, I haven't done any research on the Goodnight family. But I know that Uncle Mike Goodnight, Uncle Ellie Goodnight, his son, was a little older than Grandpa, and Grandpa was born in 1845. And I know Uncle Mike Goodnight one time owned about 2,000 acres of land. He owned from down the other side of the, he owned down from the river down to the foot of the Goodnight Hill and the Goodnight Bridge. He owned from there back almost to the New Liberty Church, a distance of about 2 miles.
But you don't know where the Goodnight came
from? I don't know where the Goodnight came from.
Are any of his descendants here in the county now?
Yes. Edward Jefferson's wife was Ethel Lawrence. And Ethel Lawrence is the daughter of Othie Lawrence and Iva Goodnight. And they live down here on the Ashby Road.
But there are no good nights as such.
There are no good nights as such. Now, Mr. Goodnight had one son, Bill Goodnight, and he went to California. And he had some children, and the last one that I knew, a son that I knew, married sister of Mr. Dell Gregory in this county. And she had first married Tom Sparrow, and they went to California, and after Tom died, he was sent back. And then she married one of Mr. Goodnight's grandson. And I've lost touch with that family entirely. I did the funeral of this Goodnight woman that was sent back several years ago. Mm-hmm. But I've lost. I remember seeing Mr. Bill Goodnight mm-hmm. one time at the Beaver Creek Lodge. Mm-hmm. Now the people lived in Van Buren and vicinity. Just what was their standards of living. I would say that though none of them had, except Mr. Driscoll, had what was called money in those days, that everyone lived real well. There were a few improvident families, just a few, not many. But the most of them had a nice killing of hogs. They would have their hounds and shoulders and bacon and sausage and they had their poultry, and Van Buren always had a beef company, which was true also of Johnsonville, of Wardsville, and of Klondike and the various little villages around and Fairview, and they had a good meat supply. And then in those days, if they decided they wanted a mess of fish, they took their seine and went out to Salt River. And I want to tell you, if you had some channel cats that they caught in those days, are some of those fine, big, they called them jumpers. They were big mouth bass. And then there used to be a lot of fine white perch. If you get those when they were fresh, and have people that knew how to cook them, and make good old-fashioned cornbread, and have you some coffee, that you had a dish that was just really fit for the God. And they knew that, and they had their fish fries out close to Van Buren, and on up further, up what was known as the Driscoll Mill Pond. And by the way, I attended that fish fry there once when there were 110 people ate, and counting the men, women, and children, and we had enough fish, and they had brought some pies and cakes and other things, but we had enough fish and coffee and cornbread for everybody, and then we had about 100 pounds of nothing but channel cats left after we had eaten that.
So they really didn't have to preserve fish because the fish were usually available.
Nobody preserved it.
It was there.
And then we had a lot of, you asked something about some of the pastime. Well, we had a few excellent fishermen. I would mention Clay Bergen. I would mention Tyler Bergen. I would mention Will Everett Sparrow. I would mention Keelan Sparrow and his brother Alonzo. All of them were good fishermen. And they liked in the middle of May, they liked to get their long cane poles and go and catch a good bucket of peeler crawls and go down to the Driscoll Mill Pond and wade out just a little bit and fish in the channel. And every now and then you'd see them bring up one of those that would strike, and he was just about like a game fish, and they really had a good time. And most of those went and during the season they tried to go fishing about once every week.
Did anyone swim in the river?
Oh yes. The Driscoll Mill Pond was the old swimming hole, and on Saturday afternoons and Sunday afternoons, I have seen as many as 40 or 50 swimming at that time. That was when we had real joy. We were clear off away from everybody, and we swam bare. No one knows about how it means to a boy when he's walked a mile or two and pretty hot, maybe he's taken a drink from a, drink from a dripping spring, eaten a few of the wild raspberries that grew up at the side of Driscoll Mill Farm, and then got on and shucked his hickory shirt and cottonade pants and buckeye hat and plunged into the pleasant water and swam across two or three times. And then, of course, we used to have little water fights and smash each other with mud or sand or one thing or another. But we had a good time.
So girls never did swim then?
Oh, no. No. If I believe then in those days, if they'd have been, if some people, some of the older people of that day had seen a group of young people clad as they are now, the boys in trunks and the girls in bikinis, well, I don't know what would have happened.
Do you think these old timers would resent the town being flooded by the new dam?
Well, I don't know. It's always been, you know, someone said that that each older generation always said the youngster were going to hell in a basket. That was an old time expression. And I guess they would. For instance, there's a lot of things I have trouble in accepting myself. I have trouble accepting long hair. And still, I think the prettiest girls that I see on the street, now and then I see one or two, they're dressed in a nice frilly dress, and they look feminine. They don't try to look masculine at all. They don't try to come down to the boys' level. But I remember that Alexander Pope said, "Be not the first by which the new is tried, nor yet the last to lay the old aside." But I know also that Paul said, "Prove all things and hold fast to that which is good." We had a few things that I believe was good. One thing, that we didn't get in a hurry. We had time to rest. We had time to stop and say hi to a neighbor. And we had time to stop and play with a little child at the side of the road. Today, I want to speak a few words in regard to the New Liberty Christian Church and the adjacent cemetery. This historical church, which by the way has been awarded one of the heritage plaques, is located about 20 miles west of Lawrenceburg, on 1 mile north of the junction of the New Liberty and Road and Highway 62. This church was founded by Henry Spire Jr., and he, by the way, was a half-brother of Nancy Hanks. And it was its first formal entry in the church records was on February the 25th, 1862. That was a church, by the way, before that time. The first church was of hewed logs, and this was replaced by a frame building in 1881. I might say that my paternal grandfather was one of the committee, the building committee of that church that was built in 1881. The description of this church built would be a little bit hard to define, because the people of today don't realize what those churches were because they haven't seen them. They did not have the means of sustaining the ceiling, and a church was built, a sort of a barn-like structure, and down through the center of it was a row of posts, and these were made of a box formation of plank, the desired length. And the lighting of that church was, of course, the coal oil lamps. And they were on wall brackets on the wall. And we had a very fancy swinging lamp, was given by the grandmother of the late Tom and Klein Bowles of this county, of this town, the Lawrenceburg. And the present church building was erected in 1937, and Dr. John S. Chambers, who has retired as president of the Kentucky Council of Churches at Lexington, was a minister at that time. And since the first church was built, of course, it was just a one-room structure with the entry and two Sunday school rooms on each side in front, which could be opened and put into the auditorium. But since that time, there was first a basement and a kitchen and some Sunday school rooms and a study for the pastor made back in the early 60s. And then about 1972, the restrooms were added and a new cistern built. And the church now has air conditioning, and it's rather modern for a church out in the country. And with the history, and by the way, this church, of course, is about the fourth oldest in the entire county.
What is the oldest church, do you know?
The oldest church is Fox Creek Church, which was founded in 1840. The next one was the city of the First Christian Church in Lawrenceburg. I want to introduce now, and at this time, two of my copies, that is a good portion of them, of the of my column of the regular weekly column in the Anderson News. This one was written on July the 8th, 1976, and beginning here, we read the following. Not many Lincoln students are aware that most of the many books and pamphlets that have been written on Lincoln's ancestry, his early life, and the role played by Kentuckians in shaping his life were written by those not native to this state. Dr. William E. Barton did come to Anderson County and acquiring the services of the Honorable William H. Townsend, himself a Lincoln authority, secured the depositions of two Anderson Countyans, Amanda Pilcher and William Art Spare. This was back in 1922, and these sent down to Elizabeth Crutcher for a third deposition to be used as a research in the later life of Lincoln, produced by Dr. Barton. I think it would be interesting to historians if we read one of these from the oldest of these. And this is a statement of Amanda Pilcher. And she, by the way, was a granddaughter of the Reverend Henry Spare Jr., a founder of this church, and of course, a great-granddaughter of Henry Spare Sr. and Lucy Shipley Hanks. This is a statement of Amanda Pilcher. My name is Amanda Pilcher, wife of C.W. Pilcher, and I am 70 years old, my birthday being May the 27th. My mother's name was Sarah Spire, and she was the daughter of Henry Spire, Disciples of Christ minister. I've always understood that my grandfather, Henry Spire, was an uncle of Abraham Lincoln. This fact has been recognized in the Spire family ever since I can remember. My grandfather Henry Spire has the following brothers and sisters, all of whom I personally knew: Thomas, George, James, Betsy Franklin, Lucinda Campbell, Peggy or Margaret Ingram. Besides these, I have heard my mother speak of another sister of Henry Spire named Polly, who lived in Boyle County. It seems to me that she married a man named Whitehouse up there, but I am not sure as to this. My grandfather lived to be real old and is buried at New Liberty Church, where his birth and date death may be found on his gravestone. These, by the way, he was born in 1802 and died in 1881. For a long time, I've had a picture of Abraham Lincoln in my box, where I keep the family pictures, including the only photograph in existence of Henry Spare. I am giving W.H. Townsend this photograph of Henry Spare, and he is to have some enlarged for us, me, if possible. And by the way, that the copy of that is the one that I gave to the Anderson County Library. So that is one of the depositions, and this was signed on August the 6th, 1922. And Mr. Townsend secured that for his own file and for that of Dr. Barton. I want to take up my column again here. We made the statement to a friend when we saw the announcement of the meeting for planning Anderson County's formal bicentennial celebration that no real observance could be held without calling on the schools and churches for active participation in many of the events. The well-loved W.D. Moore was not only a well-known Baptist preacher in this section, but an educator who, as superintendent of schools, played a vital role in the education of the boys and girls of Anderson County in the last decade of the 19th century. We're glad that we knew and were influenced by B.F. Adkins, teenage Confederate soldier, a real dirt farmer, and Baptist preacher who served many small rural Baptist churches so faithfully and well. Adolphus Mountjoy, great uncle of Lynn Mountjoy, spent many a night in our home in our early boyhood. And a search of marriage records at the courthouse would show that many marriages of couples from the Christian churches of Anderson County were performed by Brother Mountjoy, as were many from the Baptist churches by Brother Adkins. These were young men that followed the footsteps of Reverend Eleven Merritt, the Reverend Henry Spire Jr., of whom we wrote last week. We'd like also to mention the Reverend C.S. Allen, a native of Nelson County, who served as pastor of the New Liberty Christian Church prior to World War I. In fact, his ministry extended into 1918, when illness terminated his service with that church. Horse and buggy crowds filled this one-room church to capacity on preaching days when Brother Allen first came to New Liberty, and he lived to see quite a few Model T's parked before the church on his Sundays there in late teens. Having read Cochran's Fool of God and Raccoon John Smith, we could classify Brother Allen as the Raccoon Smith type. A man who farmed and reared a large family, he was a fluent speaker, well versed in the Bible, and was much sought after as in revival meetings. Brother Allen died in 1920 and is buried in the cemetery at the old Mill Creek Baptist Church about 3 miles east of Bardstown. Back in the period from 1937 to 1945, when we served the Butland Christian Church's minister, we often stopped by the cemetery at Mill Creek for a few moments of meditation at the grave of the old ministering friend, to whom we used to listen as he told of his many experiences as a family man, a country preacher. Coming from an influential Nelson County family, he had made a large financial sacrifice to serve small country churches. And one of the pleasant memories, of course, that Ms. Fire and I both have, is that of Brother Allen, his family, and his ministry. We visited in the home of many of his descendants who now live in the Nelson County area that we mentioned before. We want to introduce here now one of our other columns, and this was written on July the 15th, 1976, and this has directly to do with the cemetery that's adjacent to the New Liberty Church. We noticed that both newspapers and television, in their observance of the bicentennial, dealt largely with the many individuals who had played an important role in our 200 years of history. It was our feeling that we could best serve the purpose of our own county's 2 weeks of observance by going back to the place that we know best, the silent village of the dead that lies adjacent to the New Liberty Christian Church, some 20 miles west of Lawrenceburg. We're indebted to Elvin Bergen, who helped us acquire the names and dates from the weathered monuments of this cemetery. In previous columns of our own, and in some of the excellent columns of the late Y. Sheely, some of the information we propose to give in this week issue has already been given. However, it is our purpose to attempt to list the 19 close kinsmen of President Lincoln who rest here in one article. We shall begin with Henry Spire, Jr., born in 1802, died in 1881, the founder of the New Liberty Christian Church, the first entry of this book for the church that was established as a part of the great restoration movement that was begun by Barton Stone, was dated February the 25th, 1862. Henry was married to Elsie Smith. She was born in 1805 and died in 1896. Their daughter, Polina, 1826 and 1896, married Alan Snyder, 1897. Their daughter, Melissa, 1850 and 1863, was the first one buried in the cemetery by the church established by her maternal grandfather. Other children of Henry and Elsie Spire and their spouses are Sarah Spire, 1822-1829, Pryor Burge, 1809-1894. And these, by the way, are our own maternal great-grandparents. Martha Spire, 1842-1916, married Elijah Case, and he was born in 1842 and died in 1914. A son, Arch Spire, 1835 and 1892, and his wife was Sally White, and she was born in 1836 and died in 1920. Henry Jr., one of the four sons of Henry Spire Sr., and Lucy Shipley Hanks, I made a mistake here in writing this, that should have been, yes, Henry Jr., one of the four sons of Henry Sr. and Lucy Shipley Hanks, is the only one of the eight children of this couple that are buried in this cemetery. And I might pause to say here that these, some of these others, including them, are my own paternal great-grandparents, are buried down on what is known as the old Willow Creek church site, down near its the mouth of Willow Creek, there where it enters into Salt River. And this, by the way, will be covered by water. I think we might have mentioned that in some of the questions that you asked me about Van Buren and the effect of the dam. But we'll mention this again, that this probably will be covered. I don't know just how much, but it will be partially covered by the dam that is to be built at Taylorsville. And then we have another Henry Spire, and this is, and by the way, these that I'm listing now are the children of George Spire and Susan Ingram that buried in the cemetery. They had a Henry, but everyone called him Harry to distinguish him from the other Henry that we shall mention. And he was born in 1844 and died in 1910. And his wife was born, was Elizabeth Ashby, and she was born in 1849. And her death date was never put on her stone. And then William T. Spire was a brother of Harry, and he was born in 1836. And he died in 1908, and his wife was a sister of Elizabeth, the wife of his brother Harry, and she was born in 1842, Delilah Ashby, 1842, and died in 1910. Now, Nancy B. Spire and Green B. Spire, these were cousins, and Nancy was the daughter of George, and she was born in 1838, died in 1906, and her husband, Green B., born in 1832, died in 1908. Now, the children of Thomas Spire, and by the way, Green B. was the children of Thomas Spire, the others of that is George Spire, born in 1826 and died in 1900, and Mary Stevens, 1826 and died in 1912. Paul is here to mention that these are George and Mary Stephen Spire are the great grandparents, by the way, of Clarence Sparrow that lives here in Lawrenceburg, and Clarence Ray Sparrow, his brother. That this is their paternal grandparents. And then we have another William Sparrow, and he's William G. Sparrow, and he's was the son of Thomas, and he was born in 1830 and died in 1918. And Elizabeth Ingram was his wife, born in 1839, died in 1917. I might pause right at this point to say that as one of the older ones, you see, he was born 30 years before the Civil War. And I remember his being at our house, and I heard him mention the name Shipley, and I heard him mention many of these people. And he knew all of these people that I've been talking about, and he knew their ancestry. And one of our regrets is that we didn't ask him some more questions. We could have found out other things. For instance, we do not know where the grave of Henry and Lucy is. But Uncle Bill could have told me, had I just been interested enough and known enough to look into the future and how these things would be sought, because I know one man and a prominent attorney from up at Yorkville, Illinois, has spent several thousand dollars in searching titles in Mercer County, trying to find the identical plot of land that Henry Sparrow owned up there, in hopes that they might find the family cemetery where he's buried. And then we have some of the others buried there. Is Elizabeth Sparrow, and she married Henry Crutcher, and 11 W. Sparrow married Margaret Elizabeth Case. And by the way, these are my paternal grandparents. Grandpa was born in 1845, died in 1941, lived a little past 96 years. And my grandmother was born in 1847 and died in 1919. And by the way, I had just gotten back from overseas and had been home 4 days when she suddenly passed away. Now James Sparrow lived a great deal of his latter life in Spencer County, but he was brought back to New Liberty and buried in the cemetery there. He was born in 1840 and died in 1908, and his wife was Polly Gilpin. She was born in 1845 and died in 1922. Now Henry Sparrow, this is Henry Sparrow, that's the son of Thomas, and he was born in 1836 and died in 1887, and his wife was Lucy Nutgrass, born in 1843 and died in 1950. And by the way, I might point to just a little thing of interest here, that when Aunt Lucy's sale was held after her death in 1915, she had an old Seth Thomas clock, and Mr. Tom Baum, the father of the late Ben Baum, was at that sale and bought that Seth Thomas clock for $3.50. My father has often said many times that why he stood there and let that clock sell. Of course, we had two, but that was Uncle Henry and Aunt Lucy's clock, and we let it go. But I don't know, it's in some of the Baum family, I imagine, at this present time. Now we have another line that comes here, and these are the children of James Sparrow, and his first wife was Nancy Hindman, and they lived then close to Gravel Switch, Kentucky, and one of the church records up there for 1850 shows that James and Nancy Sparrow were members of that church. And they had one son or two, and after the death of Nancy, James came to Anderson County, where he married Parthena Van Deventer. And Parthena Van Deventer, by the way, is buried down at the old Willow Creek Church, and I think James is buried down there also. I'm not sure whether he was taken back, because some of the markers are gone from that place. I'm not sure about that. But now, one of the sons of James a son of James and Parthena Van Deventer Sparrow, was William Arch Sparrow. He was born in 1857 and died in 1939, and his wife was Dovey Cranville, and she was born in 1861 and died in 1931. Now, Elizabeth Sparrow, daughter of Henry Sr., and Lucy married Cleveland Frankton. They had one son, James Frankton. He was born in 1844 and died in 1910. And his wife, Gabriella Tinsley, was born in 1850 and 1941, and she also sleeps by his side. Now, of the 18 first cousins of Lincoln that rest in the New Liberty Cemetery, all the graves had a stone except that of Mike Sparrow, the son of Thomas and Mary Smith Sparrow. From our early boyhood, we had been told that the large cedar tree in the cemetery marked Uncle Mike's grave. For years, we'd been trying to find the date relative to him and his wife, but we had run up against blind alleys. Our thanks to our good friend, Hugh H. Hawkins, who furnished us with the following data from Anderson County Census Rolls for 1860 and 1870. The 1860 census lists the dwelling house number 958 and was headed by Mary Sparrow and one of her seven children listed as Michael. And he was 21 at this time in 1860. And now we know that he served in the Union Army, and from a deposition of Elizabeth Crutcher that is given on record down in Frankfort, Kentucky, the Historical Society, we find that his wife was Laura White. And then the census for 1870 lists Laura White as the head of the house, and Michael had evidently died between 1860 and 1870. Now, we know that they had three sons, and they went to Illinois. So there's just a little more data that Thomas and Mary Sparrow had a daughter, Levina Sparrow, and she married Alexander Mathley. And then there was a Martha E. Sparrow that was married to Silas Ashby, but she is buried in the cemetery at in Nelson County. I believe we might have mentioned that in Nelson County, that is not far from Van Buren, because that was she was buried in the Green's Chapel. It's a Methodist cemetery, Methodist church, and adjacent cemetery. I didn't mention here, I don't believe, Elizabeth Crutcher, and she married Henry Crutcher, and he was a Civil War soldier. By the way, we have a list of these Civil War soldiers, I think, here. I have Elizabeth Elijah Keyes, of course, the one I mentioned that married Martha E. Sparrow, and separate Keyes. This was a brother of my paternal grandmother. He was a Civil War veteran. James Sparrow was a Civil War veteran. He was another of the sons of Tom, own brother to my paternal grandfather. Michael Sparrow, that we just mentioned, was a Civil War. And William T. Sparrow, that was the son of George, he was a Civil War veteran. And Arch Sparrow, there are two Arch Sparrows, there's Arch and William Arch. This Arch Sparrow, as I mentioned, was a Civil War soldier that married Sally White. And then George Sparrow, that married Mary Stevens, was in. And this Henry Sparrow, that married Lucy Nutgrass, was also a Civil War veteran. And Henry O'Hara Sparrow was another one of the veterans. And Henry Crutcher was a veteran. I might mention that Uncle Henry Crutcher used to always, he was the last surviving veteran there. And on Decoration Day, and by the way, on the fourth Sunday, I think we mentioned that one time in the other tape that we made, but on the fourth Sunday in May, or the last Sunday in May, rather, sometime there was a fifth Sunday in May, that it used to be that probably 1,000 people would come and go, and sometime there were 600 or 700 at a time at the New Liberty Church. And by the way, Will Townsend visited that one of those, and Dr. Barton was there, and Dr. Lewis A. Warren. All of these are noted Lincoln historians, and they visited and got a lot of their material from this New Liberty Cemetery.
Were these veterans belong to the Confederate Army?
No, So far as I'm concerned, that so far as I know, there's not a Confederate veteran in that buried in that cemetery. Now this, I think a lot of those were Democrats. In later life, I remember Uncle Bill and Uncle Billy and Uncle Art. They were always prominent Democrats in politics here in Anderson County. But I think the fact that that the cousin of these was president of the United States at the time, and as you know, Kentucky was a divided state during the. I mentioned before that in my grandmother's family, two boys came home on. I might have mentioned what being the tape that I made before that two of the boys in my on my maternal side were home on leave, one wearing the blue and one wearing the gray, and because Kentucky was a divided state. But in the fact of the New Liberty Church, and at the conclusion of this program, I have a little thing that I want to read, and we'll tell that just a little more fully. But at the conclusion of I would say that these people, though they were Democrats, they were also unionists. They believed in the principles enunciated by Thomas Jefferson, but they believed with their cousin Abe Lincoln, who was president of the United States, that the Union must be preserved. They believed that it would be the greatest mistake of the world to divide. Actually, we know that that now historians know that the Civil War was not fought because of slavery. It was not slavery that was the thing. But there were various things to be too long to go into in making this brief tape. But these people, I think, were influenced by the preaching of their grandfather, or their uncle, Uncle Henry. I think these were all. See, these were most of these veterans. In the case of Uncle Lige, Henry Spire was his father-in-law. In the case of Art Spire, it was his dad. In the case of James and George and Henry and William and these others, it was their uncle. So they were influenced, and oftentimes they had prayer. They had prayer for to sustain their. You remember that one of the on the walls of the Lincoln Memorial, that in his farewell to the people of Springfield, one of the things he asked that the people pray for him, that they sustain him by prayer. And one of the poets, you know, has talked about Abraham Lincoln walking at midnight, and he was meditating and praying in agony that he wasn't, of course he was affected. He said one time when he saw a slave block down on a trip down to New Orleans, when he went down on the flatboat to New Orleans, he said, if the time ever comes that I ever change, I'll strike that thing as hard as I can. But still, that was not primary in Lincoln's philosophy of why they were waging war. It was to save the Union.
Do you know how they happened to name the church New Liberty?
I have never known exactly why it was that, because it was first known as Spire's Union because of the great number of Spires that lived there. And by the way, now that there are very few of that name that come. Hubert Spire, that lives out here by Stringtown. He and his wife and younger son go down there. And then Mrs. Charlie Sparrow. And I believe that that's the only one that bears a name. Several of them were Sparrows and they're married. Other names are a few, but not many of the Sparrows live there and come to church there now anymore. They've all gone.
How many members did they have in their early years?
Oh, back in, I remember just after I came back in. From World War One, and after we had married in 1919, and they had asked me to reorganize the Sunday school. I can remember that we had more than 200 in attendance at Sunday school when we had preaching twice a month.
It's a good sized church then.
It was a good sized church. It was bigger than, because most of the people, if you look at all these subdivisions around Lawrenceburg, and You'll see where the people have come from. Not only we've had some from adjoining counties come because of some of these factors that have been brought in here, but you go down and look at the empty houses and the places where houses have burned and no houses were ever replaced anymore. Now we have, I talked to the principal and his wife from down at Western High School, the first established 50 years ago last fall down in at western part of Anson County, Western High School, and they tell me that a few new people have moved in. They have some new ones and they have a little increase in enrollment. And that's the only hope, by the way, of saving that, and it's the only hope of building. Now they have about an average of about, I would say, between in 80 plus in attendance at preaching service, and 70 plus in attendance of Sunday school regularly all the time at the New River Church now.
Now this is a Church of Christ.
It's a Christian church.
Christian church.
It's one of the conservative Christian church. You see, the Christian church is divided into two groups. The progressive group, I call themselves Christian church, and also the in parentheses down below, you'll see Disciples of Christ. And the conservative branch, which by the way is the larger in Kentucky, and and you see, the Christian church has came into existence around here. I mentioned Barton W. Stone earlier in this tape. I mentioned Barton W. Stone and Alexander Cowan. Well, and of course Raccoon John Smith. These were people in this area, and the beginning of the Restoration Movement, of course, which is the beginning of the Christian church on the site. It was not the purpose of Barton Stone when he had held his Kingridge meeting. It was not the purpose of Barton Stone to form a new denomination. But he said there are too many denominations now. And one of the things we want to do is to get rid of all of these denominations and all come together. And they had Thomas Campbell had announced in his declaration and address had enunciated that he said, where the Bible speaks, this is our foundation. Where the Bible speaks, we speak. And where the Bible is silent, we'll be silent. And it is his purpose to do away with all written creeds and take simply the New Testament. I think what Brother Campbell meant when he said, where the Bible speaks, we speak, and where the Bible is silent, we're silent, it's always been my interpretation that he meant this, that if the Bible speaks, that's authoritative. Man doesn't have a right to change that. But where the Bible is silent, that we can put this in. The Bible says nothing about our form of music, whether we shall have shaped notes or round notes. And the New Testament is silent on musical instruments in church, although one branch of the Christian church branched off a good number of years ago. And on the question of instrumental music, they said it was an innovation and that the Bible didn't authorize it. But I think that Mr. Campbell's added that where the Bible speaks and where the Bible is silent, we can be silent. That is, we have no right to say if somebody wants some music or not. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing about the missionary societies and Bible colleges and Sunday schools and what have you. it might be of interest to a good many people that would listen to this tape and later on, that I have before me here a copy of the Lincoln Kinsman, and the title of this was edited by Dr. Lewis Warren at Fort Wayne, Indiana, in May of 1939, and the title of it is James Wright Sparrow, and the subtitle is His Descendants Were Close Kinsmen of Abraham Lincoln's Mother. But what I want to particularly call attention to, that of many of these that I have mentioned in the New Liberty Christian Church Cemetery, here's the dates of their weddings. For instance, the Green Bee and Nancy Sparrow were married January 27, 1857 in Anderson County. And also that Henry and Elsie Smith, that's the founder of the church, they married in Mercer County on February the 12th, 1822. And James and Nancy Hindman, that I mentioned up at Travel Switch, they were married August 28th, 1818 in Mercer County. And then he married Parthena Van Deventer in Anderson August the 12th, 1850. And evidently that Nancy must have died early in 1850, because they both were listed as members of the church at Gravel Switch in 1850. And then Sarah and John Crutcher, October 21st, 1841 in Anderson County. And by the way, this Sarah was the wife we mentioned before, was the wife of Prior Bird. She was married prior to her marriage to Prior Bird, when she married John Crutcher, and they had two sons. And my paternal great-grandparents, Thomas and Mary Smith, were married April 11, 1836 in Anderson County. But Thomas and Sally Smith, his first wife and sister to Mary, were married in Mercer County in 1826 on the 31st of July. And then I mentioned William Sparrow, and that married Elizabeth Ingram, and they married in 1857 in Anderson County. And William T. Sparrow and Delilah Jane Ashby, they married January 11, 1858 in Anderson County. And by the way, anyone wishing to write to the Lincoln Life the Lincoln Life people at Fort Wayne, Indiana, I don't know, Dr. Gerald McVertry, he is director of the museum there, then one can write to Dr. Gerald McVertry, Lincoln Life Insurance Company. And by the way, the Lincoln people got permission to use these people got the permission to use this from Robert Lincoln, and they were to do what they could to collect Lincoln history for using the name. And by the way, I might mention, and there's very few people that know this, I think very few even Lincoln historians know this, but you know, Robert Lincoln had to live in the shadow of his father's greatness. And there had been so many derogatory things written about his father. Some things like Edgar Lee Masters wrote his his life of Lincoln, and was a derogatory thing. And he was a defamation of Lincoln's character and of his family and all. And many other people, by the cupidity of William Herndon, that wanted to make some money out of selling books. He had a lot of his father's private papers. They were letters. Some of them were valuable, some of them were not too valuable historically. But he was going to burn them up. And some of the historians said, Mr. Lincoln, don't do that. said, keep them, turn them over to us, the historian, and then we'll agree that we won't publish them until a certain number of years after your death. And some of the things that recently come out in regard to Lincoln were found in those papers. And of course, new letters are turning up. They're still turning up, even in this late date, 1976. Mm-hmm. And I think that, by the way, I want to make this mention that I should say that Mr. James A. Peterson of Yorkville, Illinois, has done more to clear the name of Lincoln, of Lincoln's grandmother and of his mother, to clear them of any stigma of disgrace in regard to, you see, historians like Carl Sandburg said that Nancy was an illegitimate child. And of course, it was rumored during the Lincoln's campaign for president that his parents were never married. Of course, after the era of Dr. Lewis E. Warren, he began to go, these people were way off and never been to Kentucky, and they were writing Lincoln books. And Dr. Lewis Warren and William E. Townsend and people Mr. Peterson, by the way, Mr. Peterson is about 80 years old now, and but they came and talked to the people I just mentioned that I used to talk to. Uncle Bill was born in 1830. Well, wouldn't Uncle Bill know more about his cousin and more about his grandmother and more about his Aunt Nancy and Uncle Tom than people that lived 1,000 miles away and were never even in Kentucky?
Seems so.
Mr. Peterson did this in his first book that he wrote. It's called Henry Lucy Hanks. And of course, by the way, we know that she was married to Henry Spire Sr. On April 26, 1790. Well, as an attorney, Peterson went into the records in the on file in the Historical Society at Harrisburg, and he sifted out just what was to this grand jury indictment of Lucy Shipley Hanks on a moral charge. Well, he found out that as a lawyer, he goes and tells that when this was investigated, it was just dismissed, and he explains it in lawyer's lingo. He says it was dismissed because there was no foundation, no basis for the things. And I might say I mentioned that her son, Henry Spire Jr., was the founder of the New Liberty Church. Her grandson, George Bird, preached there, and he was a preacher of the Christian Church. And I mentioned in my tape on Van Buren that I hated to see the ashes of Uncle George have to be disturbed from that cemetery at Van Buren. And J.J. Whitehouse, a great-grandson great-grandson of Henry Spire, and a great-great-grandson of Lucy Hank. And O.T. Spire, a son of James Spire and Polly Gilpin, I mentioned. And of course, this is a direct descendant. He was preached for 65 years and retired at age 85 in Miami Springs, Florida, this last May. And then he has a son, Coleman, that's a minister in Florida. And then he has a grandson that's a minister. Well, we have Elmer Spire, that's now interim pastor at Mendenham Christian Church, and Raymond Spire, the present pastor. They're both descended. And then there's one of the Huff boys that is descended of this line, is a minister. And there are three Baptist preachers that I know that are ministers who are descended from this line. And Dr. Barton, in his, when he came to Anderson County and studied and to get his some material for his Life of Lincoln, he said this was the Spire family. He said it was interesting to note that they were never found in court. None of them were ever brought up in court for anything. He never could find a single instance when he came to Anderson County in 1922, and that was in the era when there were plenty of Spires living at New Liberty Christian Church. Brother Bill Moore was the pastor of the New Liberty Church at the time of the centennial in 1962, and they asked that I come and deliver the centennial address. And one of my prize processions is that I have a picture that made by Eddie Garrison, managing editor of the Anderson News, that was made on that occasion. It shows quite plainly numbers of my family, and I'm glad that I have a picture, and the late wife, she shows up plainly in that, as we do a number of other friends. Frank Wright, the late Frank Wright, president, former president of the Anderson National Bank, he and Moselle and Joanne, it shows that picture, and I'm glad that I have that. And in my book that I published in 1975, on page 17, that I up at the next to the top paragraph on the on page 17, that I speak of a statement of one of Joe Creason's articles. I say Mr. Creason begins his article with these words: "The distant sounds of a church bell drifting across the countryside, calling its members to worship, is unmistakably associated with rural Kentucky. The bells have a metallic, business-like sound. Some are urgent, some sonorous, but all are compelling. Perhaps no more than during the Easter season. I remember with pride the building of the cupola, of the installation of the bell at the New Liberty Christian Church, where I grew up and was one time its minister. Although it has been a sort of loose organization in people's home, before the first permanent church organization, it was not until February the 25th, 1862, that formal church records were begun, and Henry Spire, my maternal great-grandfather, was installed as its minister. I do not know if Mr. Creason had ever visited the New Liberty Church or not. I know that he would be vitally interested in the cemetery where not only Nancy Hanks had brother lives, but 18 first cousins of her illustrious son. Some 50 years ago, it was not unusual to find more than a thousand people gathered at this cemetery for Decoration Day observance. Dr. William E. Bachman and late Will H. Townsend collected some of their material for Lincoln books at the place from many of the kinsmen of the martyred president. It was my heavy privilege to have been called to give the centennial address of this church on February the 25th, 1962. The Anderson News gave good coverage of this service, and I highly prize the picture of that service given to me by its managing editor. For many subscribers of the News who were present at that service, and for those who have requested it, I'm including this thought with which I close my address. New Liberty Christian Church, 1962. I am the New Liberty Church. I was first organized during the turbulence of Civil War. In those unhappy days, my families had divided loyalties. Brother was pitted against brother, one wearing the blue, the other the gray. Yet those who founded me were wise men whose faith was well founded, men who believed in the simple plan of New Testament salvation. When war finally ended, I helped to heal wounds, eradicate bitterness, and bind my people together with bonds of Christian love. I weathered those early storms, and I moved forward because my foundation were these words: upon this rock I will build my church. During my 100 years, I have been an integral part of the pageant of Israelian history. I have witnessed marriage, birth, death. My people have experienced joy and sorrow, hope and despair, fulfillment and disappointment, success and failure. But always, in spite of all, there has been faith. In the silent city of the dead, beside which I've kept vigil down across the years, rest the ashes of my first pastor. Close by him sleep the kinsmen who often join him in prayer for his nephew, Abe Lincoln. Yes, many lie there who are descended from her who crooned her first lullaby to the baby girl, Nancy Hanks. I am proud of my past, but forgetting the things that are behind, I look confidently to the future. I must retrim my lamps that I may grow more and more to become a beacon light to men. I must reflect the light of Him who is the light of the world, for 'tis only His light that can dispel the darkness of the world. A torch has been thrown to you today from failing hands of a century. Be yours to hold it high. If you break faith with those who love me, serve me, and cherish me, those who have long slept close to my shadow, I know that their sleep will be troubled. Yes, you are today compassed about with a great cloud of witnesses. I am your church. I'm a part of Christ's church. I'm the New Liberty Christian Church.